Hi, good afternoon. My name is John Hamry. I'm the president here at CSIS. And I'm delighted that we're having this session, and I'm really very pleased that our three distinguished guests are with us this afternoon. This is a topic and a question that I am just very deeply interested in for a combination of reasons. America is, it's well known, America is a unusually religious society compared to other countries. And yet we have such a profound agnosticism in public life about the role of religion. It's a very interesting conundrum. We know how people of faith are hugely motivated to do remarkable things every day. You know, they're running soup kitchens, they are after-school training programs, just this tremendous wealth of things. And it's the energy, the passion, the commitment to that the faith community, in all of its glorious manifestations, does and has impact in public life. And we know the astounding role that the faith community has had internationally in being kind of agents of strong progressive change. And yet there's such a profound ambivalence in American policy circles to discuss the role of religion in public life. I think we've internalized, my view, the wrong way, the concept of separation of church and state. You know, we've let that become an intellectual blinder for all of us to keep us from understanding the power. I guess it's because government workers, I was certainly one of them for 25 years, did not want to be drawn into sectarian discussions on matters of faith, so we don't talk about it at all or think about it at all. And yet you think about this tremendous impulse in American society and the impulse that it has around the world, it's clear that we're cheating ourselves. We're cheating ourselves of an enormous insight, an enormous energy, enormous dimension that really touches the lives of so many Americans. So we want to explore that today, and we're so fortunate to have the three of you with us. Johanna, you're going to lead this discussion. So what I would ask you to do would be to introduce our speakers. You'll do that, in course, and to start taking all of us into a rich dialogue with these leaders. Let me conclude to say how grateful I am for what all of you are doing in your own ways. This is a I should just say a word. We started our series here on Smart Power, which was a series meant to say America's been spending too much of its energies on using military might to try to solve problems around the world. And it's so inefficient. When you think about the enormous strength of the so-called soft powers of diplomacy, the cultural outreach, and this humanitarian impulse, which is so powerful in our world, that we said we've got to start bringing that back to a focus. And so we started a series, and it's taken us a little longer to have this event, and I'm glad we finally have. So thank you for coming. Johanna, let me ask you to take it from here.
Well, thank you, Dr. Hamry, and once again, thanks to our guests. We just had some wonderful talent from our junior staff at a talent show, and one person didn't have their mic on high enough, and I feel I was explaining how to do it, and of course it's always the old people like me who get it wrong, but thanks a lot for being here. And it is, as I say, not only an honor to be here in this program, but also to be part of a series that Dr. Hamry mentioned, the Smart Power series, because I can't think of a subject that is more part of our Smart Power. And I see, as I look around the room, many people who've worked in the development community who precisely understand the power and the impact that faith-based groups have in the field. And therefore, with the three speakers we have today, we are going to have an opportunity to understand in greater depth and in greater vision what this means as far as being a multiplier of our own government assistance when it comes to providing not only the humanitarian side of assistance, but also the components that we also see are so important in understanding the culture and the dialogue with people whom we try to assist abroad. So today, our three speakers, and our principal speaker is Richard Stearns, who is the president of World Vision, and is going to offer some comments on the subject of the role of faith-based groups in the development program. But that's not all. We are going to be also welcome to have another two excellent speakers to comment on this. And I'm going to make sure I say your name is Scott Todd from Compassion International. We were joking before this meeting that I know a Todd Scott, and they were threatening me that I would get his name wrong, but we are very fortunate to have Scott Todd with us. His bio, like the bio of Mr. Stearns, is available for you, and you can look at that. And finally, we're going to have another very interesting speaker to comment on Mr. Stearns' remarks, and that is Ed Scott, who has an incredibly interesting background, not only in the world of business, but in the world of philanthropy, and has a great sense of the future of what philanthropy is going to look like as far as the nexus between all of these issues of development assistance, faith-based organizations, and the role that these groups have in our own society. So I don't want to take up a lot of time in starting this. I want to express the regrets, although I understand he's coming, of my colleague, Rick Barton, who was my first boss at USAID, and also to thank you all for coming out on what is an unusually cold day in Washington to hear what I think is going to be a very warm and rich set of remarks. So let me let you go forward.
Thank you, Joanna. Well, it's great to be here on this cold Washington day, and I want to thank you all for braving the weather to come out and hear our remarks today. I have to admit, I accepted the invitation to speak at CSIS with a fair amount of trepidation. You see, I don't think of myself as a think tank kind of guy, nor even a Washington insider in any way. I live in Seattle, Washington, the other Washington, and basically I'm a former corporate CEO who left the corporate world about 10 years ago because my faith values compelled me to respond to an opportunity to make a difference for the world's poor. And that's why I'm here at World Vision. So I feel a little bit uncomfortable in the whole Washington scene. And as John suggested in the introductory remarks, sometimes faith-based organizations don't feel totally at home in the Washington culture either. But it is good to be here among you and to have an opportunity to address you. I suspect that I'm representative of a great number of people who work in the humanitarian space, whether they're in secular or faith-based organizations, people who see their work as a way of putting their faith values into action. In fact, the title of my talk today, Good People, Good Work, and Goodwill, The Role of Faith-Based Organizations and Foreign Assistance, provides a framework for what I'd like to say today. And let me begin with the notion of good people. Again, as John indicated in his opening remarks, he stole all my thunder, research indicates that Americans tend to be a very religious people. In fact, according to a recent Pew survey, about 92% of Americans believe in God. And the other 8% might live in Washington. Now, I don't know if that's true. But about 92% of Americans believe in God, and about 83% of Americans self-describe themselves as Christians. So we're a very religious nation. I think we've seen that in the recent presidential campaigns, that religion always plays a role, even when the secular media would prefer it didn't play a role in the campaign. Moreover, we live in a profoundly religious world as well. According to the Center for World Missions, only about 2.5% of the world's population would say that they are atheists. So 2.5% of the 6.7 billion people that live on Earth would consider themselves atheists. And what that means is that the overwhelming majority of the world's people have a religious worldview that is shaped by their faith. The corollary to this is that the overwhelming majority of the world's people do not hold a secular worldview, interestingly enough. And yet the very idea that our government, or any government for that matter, partners with faith-based organizations in the delivery of humanitarian assistance is sometimes considered controversial, and by some considered inappropriate. The concern, of course, is that faith-based organizations, or FBOs, I'll call them, might inappropriately inject a religious worldview into their work, or they might use the humanitarian platform for proselytism. But given the religious character of so many developing world contexts, I would like to argue that while most FBOs don't inject proselytism into their work, their religious identity actually turns out to be a great advantage in the work that we do. And that's because faith-based organizations intuitively understand the role and importance of religion in community life. FBOs are better equipped to navigate the religious landscapes and use religious principles to enhance the effectiveness of their development work around the world. And there's a corollary here as well, that is that organizations with a predominantly secular worldview may be at somewhat of a disadvantage in navigating those same religious landscapes. But let's take a moment and examine one of the possible concerns around partnering with FBOs, proselytism. Proselytism is defined as using inducements to cause someone to convert to one's own religious faith. It's something that is inappropriate, it's something that is unethical, it is potentially dangerous in a world where religious extremism is sometimes violent. The Red Cross defines proselytism as requiring recipients to listen to a religious message or requiring conversion as a condition of receiving assistance. World Vision does not do this, and we have a strict policy against this practice. Most professional faith-based groups have similar policies regardless of whether their funding is from a government or a private source. Now, that doesn't mean that faith is never discussed in the course of the work that FBOs do, just that faith is never used as a club or never used as an inducement to receive aid. And I'll talk about this a little bit later. Well then, what is unique about faith-based organizations? What makes them different, and how does their faith factor into their work? Let me read you World Vision International's mission statement. And this is right off of our core documents. And it goes like this. World Vision is an international partnership of Christians whose mission is to follow our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, in working with the poor and oppressed, to promote human transformation, to seek justice, and to bear witness to the good news of the kingdom of God. In this statement, you can discern several things that are true of many faith-based organizations. First, you can see that our motivation is to follow Jesus Christ in his concern for the poor. The Christian faith, like most world religions, has a commandment to love our neighbors as ourselves. We call it the Golden Rule. And this is a commandment which Jesus called the second greatest commandment, just after the commandment to love our God with all of our heart, mind, and strength. So loving our neighbors as ourselves is not just a Christian commandment and principle, but is actually common in many of the major world religions. So at World Vision, we're motivated to care about poverty and justice because Jesus cared about poverty and justice, and he called his followers to do the same. And here's that notion of good people or people of goodwill wanting to help the poor for a very simple reason. Our faith tells us it's the right thing to do, the good and decent thing to do. We believe that God loves and values all people and wants us to love and value them as well. Indeed, the values we promote include such things as caring, compassion, justice, forgiveness, reconciliation, and the equality of all people, regardless of ethnicity, religion, nationality, or gender. These are not things that are exactly an agenda that should set off any alarms within the Beltway. The second thing you can see in our mission statement is that we're called to work with the poor and to promote human transformation and to seek justice. These are also goals very much in alignment with U.S. foreign assistance goals, promoting justice, promoting human transformation, and working with the poor to lift them out of poverty. Our foreign assistance seeks to demonstrate the essential goodness of the American people to the world. Why else would we respond to natural disasters or to poverty in countries with little strategic significance to our national interests? The answer, I believe, is because our national values compel us to do things like save lives and assist the poor in the case of a Pakistan earthquake or an Asian tsunami. It has been said that America is great because she is good, and that if America ceases to be good, America will cease to be great. Finally, in our mission statement, you find the words, bear witness to the good news of the kingdom of God. Now, I suppose that that's the uniquely religious part of our mission, but it doesn't involve proselytism. Bearing witness simply means that we want our words, our deeds, and the character of our lives to be good ambassadors for the God we serve and the faith that we embrace. Let me make one final point here. I was once interviewed by a representative of the media who was trying to build a case that it was highly inappropriate for a Christian organization to be sent into countries predominantly Muslim or Hindu or Buddhist, funded by U.S. government grants. What gave us the right, he reasoned, to impose our religious views on another culture? After pointing out to him that we don't impose our religious views on anyone, I turned the question around and I pointed it back to the reporter. I said, "Are you suggesting that freedom of speech is a right that only Americans should have, and that people who live in Indonesia or Cambodia should not have the same rights? And are you saying that our freedom to choose whatever religion we desire should not be available to the people in other countries as well? And you can't be suggesting that ideas should never be censored in the United States, but that they must be censored in places like Indonesia or Cambodia." Well, my questions, I think, caused him to think about this issue in a very different way, and it had an effect I'd never seen before in a member of the media. He became speechless for a while. You see, America is nothing if it is not a wonderful and noisy marketplace of ideas. Our sacred values of freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and freedom of religion make for an amazing patchwork quilt of diverse ideas, opinions, and worldviews. This is really foundational to our greatness as a nation. When faith-based organizations serve in other countries and cultures, they do practical things like feeding children, building houses and schools, drilling wells, and setting up microfinance loan banks. But they also bring with them values and ideas. And those values and ideas may differ from those of the people they serve. And these values must compete in the broader marketplace of ideas in those cultures and contexts. But isn't this same thing also true of so-called secular organizations? What about organizations that promote gender equality and women's rights in traditional cultures where such ideas are heretical? Isn't the same true of organizations that promote family planning to reduce family size, even when their views fly in the face of local values and traditions? Indeed, isn't the same also true for organizations that promote democracy itself? You see, every organization and every person working in an international assistance organization brings their values to work. If the U.S. government were to censor the ideas and worldviews held by each and every NGO and contractor with whom they partner internationally, there would be few left to partner with. It seems like the key principle is not to censor the ideas and worldviews of humanitarian workers, but rather to ensure that partners of the U.S. government spend their grant funds only on things approved by the government in the grant itself, and certainly not to establish any particular religion or value system. And no partner of the U.S. government should act using inappropriate coercion, whether offering birth control resources, teaching new ideas about gender equality, or in expressing their religious or secular worldviews. The second thing I wanted to talk about today was good work. It should go without saying that faith-based organizations, as government partners, should be held to the exact same professional standards as secular organizations. Grants should be awarded competitively and without bias, whether the prospective grantees are faith-based or otherwise. And World Vision and other FBOs have been trusted and able partners of the government. Contrary to popular belief, during the years of the President Bush's faith-based initiative, while many new FBOs received USAID grants for the first time, the share of NGO grants awarded to FBOs actually decreased from 14.2% to 13.5% between 2004 and 2007. So according to these official statistics, there has been no dramatic shift toward FBOs with regard to U.S. foreign assistance. All that FBOs ask for is that they are not excluded and that they be allowed to compete for foreign assistance grants on equal terms, a level playing field. Since 1995, we went back in the archives here, and since 1995, World Vision has received more than $2 billion in U.S. government grant funding. Those funds have come from USAID, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the Department of State, Labor, and Justice. We also have received funding and do receive funding from the governments of Australia, Canada, the UK, Japan, Germany, Austria, Netherlands, and Sweden, as well as the Global Fund, the Inter-American Development Bank, the World Bank, and multiple UN agencies, including UNICEF, UNHCR, UNDP, and the World Food Program. In fact, World Vision is today the World Food Program's largest global NGO partner, helping millions of people on the brink of starvation in many locations around the globe. Clearly, FBOs have and continue to make extraordinary contributions to the humanitarian imperative with both private and public funding. And by the way, for every dollar of U.S. government funding we receive about $3 of private funding from American citizens and corporations. But I'd like to suggest that there's one unique dimension to faith-based organizations that has great leverage in relief and development work around the world, and that is the ability to partner with and mobilize the faith communities that exist in virtually all of the project communities abroad. In a world where 97.5% of the population believe in God, FBOs are uniquely suited to speak to faith leaders and institutions in a language that they respect and understand. And faith leaders in churches, mosques, and temples have great influence and moral authority in their communities. In other words, if you want to bring about changes in any of any kind in a community, you will improve your likelihood of success if you intentionally engage and involve the faith leaders of that community, something that FBOs understand and are uniquely qualified to do. Let me give you an example from World Vision's work with HIV and AIDS in Zambia. Zambia is a majority Christian country with a population of about 12 million and has an adult infection rate of 17% with about 1.2 million orphans. There are 14,000 Christian churches in that little country of Zambia. But just a few years ago, most of those churches were doing nothing to address the social issues caused by AIDS. Not only were they not doing much to help those living with HIV and AIDS, or the widows and orphans left behind, many of these churches were part of the problem, believing that those with AIDS were being judged by God and were getting what they deserved. World Vision convened a conference in 2003 in Lusaka for church leaders across all denominations. We confronted the leaders with the facts about AIDS and the stigma in their culture against those living with or affected by the disease. We then showed them what the Bible said about compassion for the sick and not judging others. We exhorted them to assert their moral authority to change attitudes toward AIDS in their communities and to use their churches to deliver care for widows and orphans. We encouraged them to preach and teach about sexual fidelity to one partner and abstinence before marriage for teenagers, teachings that would prevent the spread of the disease. The leaders responded to our message, and the result was the formation of a multi-denominational group in Zambia called the Expanded Church Response Committee, formed with the purpose of training and equipping churches to respond positively to the AIDS pandemic. Bishop Banda, who met with me in 2004, said that World Vision had, quote, defrosted the church in Zambia with regard to HIV and AIDS, and expressed his gratitude to me. In Africa, more broadly, our outreach program is called Channels of Hope. The Hope Project was begun to combat the stigma and turn the situation around so that churches and communities could become the primary source of counseling and care for those living with HIV and AIDS. To do this, we needed to support rather than blame pastors by addressing attitudes and providing them with the correct information. Consider this actual quote from an African pastor. He said this, "Before the Channels of Hope training, I would preach against those with HIV. I would call them sinners and say they must repent. I would tell them that they could come back to church when it was time for me to conduct their funeral. After going through the Channels of Hope, I realized that I was the one who needed to repent." That's an actual quote from one of the pastors. Pastors have unique moral authority and influence in their communities. Thousands of them have become agents of change through interactive encounters with people living with HIV and AIDS, as well as widows, orphans, and vulnerable children overseas. To date, nearly 200,000 African pastors and church leaders have participated in World Vision Hope workshops and have begun a process of changing their churches and communities through preaching, prayer, and unconditional love to people living with HIV and AIDS. Key members of congregations are often selected to form congregational HIV and AIDS task forces. Each congregation develops a strategic plan to focus on care for people living with AIDS as well as OVCs, and to instruct children about prevention through life skills education. Churches will then train members to join community care coalitions, which link volunteers from all churches in the community to serve as home visitors. So this is seen not as the ministry of one church, but the ministry of the whole community. These coalitions, community coalitions, take responsibility to provide home visits and care for the sick as well as the OVCs and their community. In Zambia, World Vision has helped to get 250,000 orphan children under care through these programs. About 18,500 volunteer caregivers, most from churches, take responsibility for approximately 5 households each, and they go around like circuit riders caring for and ministering to those who are in need because of HIV and AIDS. Many of these caregivers are themselves former clients of the World Vision Rapids program, which is supported by USAID with significant corporate foundation and American church resources leveraged by World Vision. In fact, the U.S. government has showcased our caregiver model in Zambia. Why? Because our 96% retention rate of caregivers in this country is almost unprecedented among USAID programs. World Vision can present numbers like this because we are globally a large organization. Last year, about $2.6 billion in global revenues. But I can assure you that smaller FBOs have similar accomplishments at their own scale. The Association of Evangelical Relief and Development Organizations, or AERDO, has an operational HIV/AIDS alliance implementing both care and prevention grants for USAID. Its members, such as Food for the Hungry and World Relief, have long been U.S. government partners. They are entrusted with responsibility for U.S. foreign assistance because they're effective and they're professional. But their added value, or irreplaceable value, is that their faith commitment enables transformational development led by faith communities abroad. I might add that World Vision has labored tirelessly right here in the United States with the general public, and especially the Christian community, to change negative attitudes and stereotypes toward those living with AIDS and to mobilize American churches to respond financially and with their own prevention and care programs. We have an interactive exhibit called Step into Africa, which powerfully communicates the human toll taken by AIDS, and it's been to more than 80 cities in the past 2 years, hosted by churches, and has been seen by tens of thousands of people, each of whom have been challenged to respond. In fact, back in 2003, World Vision staff even assisted Congress in drafting the original PEPFAR legislation, ensuring that 10% of the resources were directed to caring for orphans and vulnerable children in that legislation. World Vision as a Christian organization has also been effective in interfaith work, and I'll just cite a few examples, and I'm almost done. In the Philippines, conflict-ridden island region of Mindanao, oh, thank you, Joanna, we support an interfaith religious leaders network that advises on transformational development programs at both local and island-wide levels. World Vision Indonesia has developed an initiative, an innovative training program to equip interfaith religious leaders in North Maluku with basic skills in trauma healing. World Vision Cambodia has facilitated the launch of an interfaith peace-building initiative for youth, which is co-led by representatives of Buddhism, Islam, and Christianity. World Vision Kosovo facilitated the development of a strong multi-faith and multi-ethnic community council of peace and tolerance in the divided city of Mitrovica. Additionally, World Vision is facilitating an interfaith religious leaders consultation process in other parts of Kosovo and has helped create a Kids for Peace program that brings together children and youth from Muslim and Christian communities. World Vision Jerusalem West Bank Gaza is a mixture at both staffing and community programming levels of Muslim and Christian Palestinians, which is a trick to pull off if you do work in that area of the world, to have a blended staff and to bring them together to work on these issues together. After the 2004 tsunami, World Vision Indonesia built new schools in Aceh together with Indonesia's second largest Muslim organization, extending its ability to provide social welfare programs in health and education across the nation through more than 5,000 schools, several large universities, and orphanages. Beyond establishing our interfaith way of working, we have even helped build capacity in some Muslim organizations. In Somaliland, where the majority are Muslim, the mosques and other faith-based organizations are central in HIV/AIDS response and care for orphans and vulnerable children. However, as it often is with Christian pastors and priests, sheikhs and imams also sometimes fail to respond appropriately to HIV and AIDS due to fear, lack of essential information, or inappropriate attitudes. World Vision trains and mobilizes them for response and care for OVC because of their unique moral authority, their mission, and their influence within the community. The sheikhs and imams are now pledged to work to defrost their congregations to HIV and AIDS-related issues through preaching, prayer, forgiveness, and compassion. Well, I think you get the idea. Faith-based organizations not only do good work, they do it in ways that uniquely leverage their understanding of the role of faith and faith-based institutions in civil society. And they can absolutely do it across faith boundaries. A colleague of mine, who is actually here, Dave Robinson, worked with World Vision for years in Mauritania, in Islamic Republic. And he told me once of a celebratory public ceremony with government officials and Muslim religious leaders where World Vision received praise and recognition for our work. A Muslim government official said to him, "We appreciate what you have done for us, and we understand you because, like us, you are people of the book, and you are welcome in our country." You see, they understood that our religious worldview was more compatible with their worldview than the worldview of a secular agency or organization. And as a result, they saw us as brothers and sisters to them in their country. This brings me to my last point, goodwill. This compassionate service we provide unconditionally to those we serve makes us ambassadors of goodwill. We're ambassadors for the American people and for their values, and also ambassadors for the Christian faith, both of which could use a little positive PR in places like Pakistan and Indonesia. Consider the statement of a Muslim television producer in a predominantly Muslim area of Malawi. He said, and I quote, "The people here have told me that the compassion and love the World Vision staff are showing them quickly remove their initial fear that the organization might have a hidden agenda to provide services only if the people converted to Christianity. It is pleasing to note that the people here enjoy religious harmony apart from the development transformation taking place." In Pakistan a few years ago, World Vision received the state's highest award, and this is a quote from the plaque they gave us, from a grateful nation, unquote, for our 2005 Pakistan earthquake relief efforts. Survivors of the 2004 tsunami themselves cited World Vision as a top provider of aid in Indonesia, in Islamic Indonesia, and largely Hindu India. In some Buddhist majority areas, World Vision has received this trifecta. We've maintained our Christian identity, established a predominantly Buddhist financial donor base, and through the support of those Buddhist donors, assisted Muslims throughout the region. So we've gotten the three faiths together in a remarkable way. World Vision Malaysia, for example, in a country that is only 10% Christian, has a donor base of child sponsors that is 40% Buddhist. The World Vision Malaysia team of Christians, Muslims, and Buddhists assists Muslim areas in China, Thailand, and Indonesia. Professional FBOs can and do serve as the very best America has to offer as partners in U.S. foreign assistance. We are able ambassadors for the great values of the American people. You know, in the past 10 years since I left the corporate world, I've traveled more than 1,000,000 miles to more than 40 countries, and I've seen some amazing things. I have witnessed the faith of hundreds of anonymous Mother Teresas who serve in the garbage dumps and slums, the brothels and the refugee camps, tirelessly and sacrificially serving the poorest of the poor. I've seen the hungry fed, and I've seen people taught to fish and farm. I've seen wells drilled and cisterns built, the thirsty given water. I've seen the sick healed and the lame walk, and the blind given back their sight. I've met refugees who've been resettled, disaster victims who have been restored, and captives who have been released. I've seen widows comforted, orphans cared for, children freed from slavery and abuse, schools built, clinics opened, babies vaccinated, loans lifting the poor out of poverty. I've seen the impact of these incredible ambassadors, good people doing good work, transforming people's lives in the most difficult places, and creating goodwill toward the great values of freedom, equality, democracy, and compassion that are held so deeply by the American people, a people whose values flow so naturally from their faith. In closing, let me quote de Tocqueville, who seemed so instinctively to understand this. "Americans combine the notions of religion and liberty so intimately in their minds that it is impossible to make them conceive of one without the other." Thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard Stearns, for bringing back home to all of us here a basic factor that your organizations and the others represented in this room do, and that is connecting with people and connecting to their basic humanity and providing the services that everybody needs, no matter what their religion, no matter what their faith. So I think with that, it's a beginning of a good introduction to a dialogue that Scott Todd and Ed Scott will follow up with. One thing I failed to mention, that Scott Todd, in addition to being involved in the work of faith-based communities, is also a noted scientific researcher. If you'll check out his biography, he has worked on pediatric AIDS and has done in his spare time, it seems, a lot of basic science research to the improvement of mankind. So Why don't I let you take it away? And if you're comfortable, you can sit here, or you, if you'd like to, and perhaps we'll have a conversation. Thank you.
Thank you. Is my mic on? Okay. So, first of all, just to say that I couldn't agree more with the opening remarks John shared with us, and also with Rich, and he made a lot of insightful comments and made some very important points that we certainly agree with. You know, I was sitting in a coffee shop last Friday thinking about today and what I would share with you, and, you know, the mind is filled with faith-based organizations and foreign assistance and separation of church and state and a lot of very complicated dynamics there. And my wife called me, and she read this verse from the Bible to me over the phone. And I'll give you some backdrop on that here in a second, but I decided I would like to read that with you. And I know you're, you know, it's like, oh, great, we invited the evangelical, and sure enough, he brings his Bible. Hopefully you'll appreciate this. It's from the book of Acts, chapter 4, 32, and it says, "All the believers were one in heart and mind. No one claimed that any of his possessions was his own. They shared everything they had. With great power, the apostles continued to testify to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus, and much grace was upon them all. There were no needy persons among them, for from time to time, those who owned lands or houses sold them, brought the money from the sales, and put it at the apostles' feet, and it was distributed to anyone as he had need." Now, my wife didn't know that I was sitting in that coffee shop. She didn't know that I was thinking about separation of church and state and all of this stuff that we're going to be talking about today. She was calling for a different reason. She was calling because we're remodeling our house. I have a small house. I have four kids. We needed some extra space. One of the guys working on our house is a painter. And the painter last week, his name is Tom, had an accident. It was icy. We'd had a snowstorm, and he had a patch of ice, went over the median, and broke the axle on his truck. So it was totaled, and he didn't have the money to buy another vehicle. But I have an old Jeep, a Jeep CJ5, which is really cool, and I love my Jeep, but I don't use it very much. And Tom, the painter, had asked whether we might be interested in selling the Jeep. And he'd asked my wife. And well, she called and she read this verse to me over the phone. And I tell you what, I didn't need her to say anything else. I knew. I knew what we needed to do. It wasn't about selling the Jeep. It was about giving the Jeep to Tom the painter. And so we did. And that, I can't even say it now without starting to feel this emotion. I'm not an emotional guy. But even in the coffee shop, I'm there kind of looking sideways at the people like, I hope I don't have a breakdown. I'm about to give my Jeep away. And why am I doing this? Well, I'm doing it because God is telling me to do it. Okay, I know that makes some of you feel a little uncomfortable, maybe horrified. Maybe a few of you are inspired by that. But the point is this, that 2,000 years ago, these words were written. They described the beginning of a movement. And that movement is still alive today. And I've seen it countless times, and even last Friday in the coffee shop. I've seen it just a few weeks ago. I was in El Salvador, and I was meeting a pastor there. And I asked this pastor, tell me about your church. He said, well, not long ago, we weren't here. We actually had a church in the rich part of town. He's in San Salvador. Now, San Salvador is riddled with gang violence. A lot of Latin American cities struggle with gang violence, but San Salvador is really, really bad. Some of those barrios are just basically they're ruled by those gangs. And he said, we used to have the church in the rich part of town, but God told me I needed to move the church down here into this barrio. And I said, well, how did your congregation react to that? And he said, well, there was a lot of debate. They said people aren't going to go there. They don't want to go down there. And giving is going to decline. And a lot of people that go to the church here, they're not going to go down there. And he said, it didn't really matter. I knew what God had called us to do. He called me to take the church down to that barrio and begin ministering to the gang members. And I said, well, so then what happened? He said, giving declined, and a lot of people didn't come with us. And I began ministering to gang members in that community. One of them got shot and thrown in jail. It was a gang leader. And he kept ministering to that guy. I met that gang leader just a couple of weeks ago. And I asked him what his experience was, and he said, well, this pastor, you know, he kept telling me all this stuff. And even when I was in prison, and even when he knew I was guilty, he kept coming and visiting me. And when I got out, because he had just been released when I met him, this pastor helped him get a job. So this gang leader has become a Christian, and he started working with other members of the gangs there in that barrio in San Salvador. And the message of forgiveness, the message of love, the message of reconciliation, to allow somebody whose life was once dominated by intimidation and violence and creating an environment of fear to begin to believe that that's not how we're supposed to live. That's not what we were designed for. And to begin knitting Christian community there, allowing a vision and a hope for a better future in that barrio. That's what's happening now in that little part of the world, and it's happening because of the sacrifice of that pastor. So my point is that, as Rich said, he mentioned 100 anonymous Mother Teresas that he's seen, and I'm here to say that's absolutely the truth. I've seen them myself, and they're part of a 2,000-year-old movement. They're part of a movement that was here before the U.S. government. They're part of a movement that will be here after the U.S. government. They are the types of people who shape the beliefs and values of a society, that shape the culture that gives rise to its representation, that gives rise to its policies. And so it's a bit ironic, in a way, to be gathered here today to discuss what is the role of the government of faith-based organizations in humanitarian relief and assistance, when the first documented case of international relief and assistance that I'm aware of was 2,000 years ago in the book of Acts again, which I read earlier, and it had to do with a famine hitting Jerusalem and people from a distant and international land transferring wealth to help out in that famine. I think from the perspective of a member of that 2,000-year-old movement, the question is, what is the role of government in humanitarian relief and assistance? I know that might sound a little controversial, but let me finish by telling you one more story. I was at a conference a few years ago, and it was an AIDS-related conference. That is my background. And I was standing next to this guy, and he was looking beleaguered and tired, and I got to talking to him about Compassion International. And I was telling him about how Compassion International has been working for 50-some-odd years in 25 different countries. We're committed to holistic child development. Our understanding of poverty is that it is fundamentally an internal condition where a person sees themselves as a victim of circumstance and where they don't have the power to change the context in which they live and which robs them of opportunities to live out their God-given potentials. And so to really address that, you're talking about addressing an internal condition. And you're talking about a need for a long-term impact on human development. So we focus on children. We believe children are extremely important, not only strategically, but for a lot of other reasons as well. So anyway, I'm telling this guy at this conference about Compassion International and our history and measures of effectiveness and so on, and he kind of is perking up, you know. I'm talking to him, the more he's getting more interested and engaged, and then he says, well, you should apply. And I said, apply for what? He said, for a grant. A grant from who? From USAID. I mean, and it was more and more like, I don't understand. Why don't you know who I am? So here, the guy was there because he's from USAID, and his job was to be kind of that liaison reaching out to the faith-based organizations. This was during the early days of the Bush faith-based initiative stuff that was going on, and he was looking for viable partners. And, you know, here he'd found one, and he was miffed in a way. Why aren't you? And I said, oh, we don't take government grants. You should have seen the look on his face. You know, I mean, it was, why not? I said, well, you know, we don't really want to subject our partners in the field to the political winds of Washington. And frankly, we partner with Christian churches. And we can't bring a dollar to them and say, well, with this dollar comes all of these reporting requirements, and you now need to learn to keep a separate set of books and account a little differently than you've been accounting. And by the way, make sure that when you do anything good, don't tell them why. You know? It was that, and I granted, that's a simplistic notion, but the feeling is that the separation of church and state idea, when it's applied in that context of you're partnering with a little Christian church in Uganda, that they're going to feel this sense of hindrance. We said, you know, we certainly would like the money, because there's a lot of times we've said no to things we'd like to be able to do. But until the U.S. government really gets it sorted out and makes it real clear what kind of risks we'd be putting our partners in as a faith-based organization, Every few years, this conversation comes around, and we say, no. You know why? We're putting our faith in that 2,000-year-old movement of people. We have seen time and time again, we believe God mobilizes people of faith to give, even though they've already paid their taxes, even though their taxes are already being used for foreign assistance, they still give. In fact, last year there was a guy who came and he gave us $5 million. He and his wife had started a business early in life, and they had worked hard all their lives, and they'd been putting money away and saving money, and they'd reached retirement. And he was praying with his wife one morning, and they believe God told them to give away their life savings for people living in poverty. They believe God told them to give it through Compassion International. So I went there to thank him and try to assure him that his gift would be used with integrity and stewarded. And I was trying to, you know, provide that assurance. And he interrupted me and said, I didn't give the money to Compassion. I gave it to God. Now, that kind of event happens to you a few times, and it's happened more than once. A lot of givers who are anonymous and so on. You just begin to develop this trust that if you really believe that God is all-powerful and sovereign, and you really believe that you're living out your faith and responding to what he's commanded you to do, then you can trust that he'll provide. So why would a guy from Compassion International, who's clearly not interested in the government funding because we don't take it, be here? You might be asking. It is not. It is not because, boy, if we can get more allocations to those grants, then Compassion will have some financial benefit. We won't. I'm here on behalf of World Vision. I'm here on behalf of World Relief. I'm here on behalf of every other organization that's faith-based to suggest to you two things. Number one, that you need them because they are the best in the business. They are the most effective. You need their expertise. We need to recognize that 97.5% of the world is religious and get over it and stop having such a narrow interpretation of the First Amendment, which is like this zealous, proselytizing, agnostic approach to exclude the voice and expression of faith from the public square, and instead embrace that religion, embrace that faith, and work with the 97.5% of those potential individuals and organizations that you could partner with. You need them. As Compassion International looks at those opportunities, we say, for the sake of the kids, I'm here. I exist as an advocate for children. I have seen the good things that come from these other organizations, and though it will not benefit my own, for the sake of the kids out there, I want to see World Vision continue to do as much good work as U.S. government money will allow them to do within their strictures of how much control they'll allow that to have on their work. And if you give me any longer, I'm going to stand up and preach, so I'll probably just end there.
I think your sermon will continue, but it's a powerful one and a powerful message. I thank you for that. I'm going to turn over to Ed Scott for not the closing word, but actually for commenting as well. And I'd love to continue the conversation and include you, Rich Stearns.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me all right? Or do I need to crank this up hard? I come to this dialogue and this afternoon's events from a very different perspective. I'm not involved directly with delivering services for a faith-based group, nor am I a member, nor am I involved in the leadership of a church. In fact, in contrast to what Rick said about himself, I am kind of a Washington insider. I spent 17 years in the federal government. I was an assistant secretary at DOT. I spent another 17 years in high tech. I spent another 17 years in high tech, and then I became sort of a think tank guy, and so I am sort of a serial founder of Washington think tank NGOs, starting with the Center for Global Development, which some of you may be aware of. I'm the founder and chairman of that organization, and then DATA, which subsequently has become One, which I was involved in with Bill Gates and George Soros, and then an organization called Friends of the Global Fight, which represents the interests of the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria in D.C. in its work with the Congress and the White House and the administration. And then more recently, and I'll tell you a little bit about this as I extend my remarks, a thing called the Center for Interfaith Action on Global Poverty. I agree with every single thing that Rich said. I also agree with about 95% of what Scott said. The 5% I don't agree with, he and I have talked about many times over the years, because I actually think compassion should take government money. And he and I have discussed that on quite a number of times. As it turns out, I'm a fairly engaged financial supporter of Compassion International, and I'm not an evangelical. I'm sort of a kind of a dubious Episcopalian. But even though Compassion is a very strongly evangelical organization, I've been a strong supporter of theirs because they are very effective, and they deal with the issues I care about. And they do it in an extremely effective way. And I'll tell you a little story, which Scott wouldn't tell you, but a couple of years ago, after some a considerable amount of preliminary dialogue, I persuaded Compassion, and they persuaded themselves to start a very aggressive HIV/AIDS testing program with the children in their stewardship. And Scott, because of his particular background in epidemiology, was chosen by Compassion to lead that effort. And the original seed money was used by them to frame how they would go about doing this. But they were very concerned about how they were going to fund it, because at the time, in the evangelical world, AIDS was still, there was still this dubious issue about whether or not AIDS was God's revenge, and whether, you know, how people would feel about all the things that surround the AIDS thing, you know, prostitution and IV drug use and all that sort of thing. Well, Compassion is a organization that gets its money through, you know, sponsorship. On a regular basis, you know, so much a month for the child you sponsor. They did a little calculation. They figured if they asked their community to put up an extra $8 a month, and they got about a 15 to 20% response, they'd have enough money to fund the program. Well, it turned out they got an 85% positive response, and now they raise about, so it's about $6 million a year to do this from their organization, which is why Scott says he doesn't need any government money. But in any event, it's a perfect example of how the charitable impulse of people in a very well-oiled faith-based machine can do something very important and very effective in the area of global public health. Today, I don't have the exact numbers, and So I'm taking some liberties here, but they've tested around 320,000 people. Maybe it's, that's a little high, but it's around 300,000. And there's all nearly, is it about 5,000 now getting ARVs? Right in that? 12,000. So how, 12,000? 12,000 are now getting ARVs. So these are 12,000 children who are alive today who wouldn't be alive if it weren't for what they and their sponsors do for those children. When you think about the faith community, and the reason I'm founded this most recent NGO called the Center for Interfaith Action on Global Poverty, which, by the way, we have whose mission is to make more effective and to be an advocate for the faith community and its global poverty work, we have been able to bring together the people who are the real giants, like World Rich and World's Vision, like Catholic Relief Services, which probably delivers more ARVs to people with HIV than any other single organization in the world, Compassion International, the General Council of the Seventh-day Adventist, the National Association of Evangelicals, Georgetown University, the Islamic Society of North America, Religions for Peace, the Tony Blair Faith Foundation, the Washington National Cathedral. So it's a pretty diverse group of people, and it's people of American Jewish World Service. So it's people of all religious faiths, not just Christians, but as people who are Muslims, Jews, and various flavors of Christianity. And what they have in common is this point that Rich was making, and that is that they and which got mentioned in the passage he read to you, is this commonality of their religious tradition telling them that this responsibility that we all have to help those who are less well off than we have is truly an underpinning of all the major faith traditions in the world. And it's for that reason that we believe they have quite a bit to say and quite a bit to do in this space, and what we want to be able to do is make that more effective. I don't know how many of you have been exposed to Rick Warren's speech about his peace plan, but Rick has this concept that, you know, the church at the end of the road is really an highly underutilized delivery mechanism. And in giving this presentation, he underscores much of what both Rich and Scott have said today. That is to say that there are certain services and certain messages that really cannot be delivered by the government, that really can and should be delivered by most effectively by someone representing a faith institution. When you think about the HIV/AIDS pandemic, and you understand that it's a disease that very much is based on behavior, human behavior, and one major component, for example, is the status of women in various societies. To change that, somebody, you know, those values, they don't get changed just sort of automatically by people waking up one morning and doing what is the right thing. People get those values either through their educational process or they get it through their house of worship, either from the mosque or the church, and or the synagogue. And changing those values is just essential to stopping this disease in its tracks, because as long as women are treated the way they are in many, many circumstances around the world, this pandemic is just going to keep roaring right along. If you look, for example, in certain parts of sub-Saharan Africa, the infection rate for young girls between the ages of 19 and 24 is like five times that for boys in the same age group. Well, that is not an accident. That's because the men are taking advantage of those young girls. So if you want to change that, the question is, what's the best vehicle for changing those kind of attitudes? The other thing is the engagement of the community at the ground level. I just came from a lunch a couple hours ago with Mark Dybul, the head of the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, and Mark was talking about how he saw the future, and that the future of delivering assistance, particularly with respect to global public health, was going to need to transition much more from the donor recipient and much more out of the assistance arena into the local ownership arena. And the best way to do that is with the people who already have this access to the communities and are respected in the communities. Getting back to Rick gives us presentation, Rick Warren, where he shows this province in Western Rwanda, and there's four hospitals, and two of them are faith-based run. And then he shows 200 clinics, about half of which are faith-based runs. And then he shows about 5,000 churches. And he keeps superimposing these dots on the map. And he makes the point that if you can use the resources of these churches and these communities, you can really extend the work you're trying to achieve in a very significant way, and be much more effective in terms of engaging the community. So that's the kind of context in which I think this conversation is taking place. And there is no doubt that those who are concerned about the First Amendment have a good reason to be concerned. Over the years, the faith community has made some mistakes, for sure. And, you know, there's been some issues about proselytization in places like our military academies. There have been issues about the role of the church in anti-Semitism and how that's been pervasive over the years. There have been a lot of bad things happen, and which is why we have this strong tradition of separation of church and state. But the fact is that the faith community just represents this extraordinary reservoir of people who want to help people who are worse off than they are. And I think the challenge is for all of us to figure out how we, in fact, are going to make that come to pass and take the best advantage of it for the benefit of people in countries who don't have the bounty of our country. So I think that as you think about ways in which, you know, this fundamental idea can be advanced, I think you will find that the faith community continues to sort of reinvigorate itself in this space, and the current president-elect has made it very clear that this is a resource he wants to stay engaged with and extend its reach. And so I think that would be a very good thing, and I thank you very much.
Thank you, for all of you, for your excellent remarks. I'd like to do two things right now, because we have about 25 minutes left, and I would like to give an opportunity, if you'd like to respond, Rich, to any of these comments, but also to give our audience a chance to ask some questions, since we have the opportunity to have some practitioners and or faith-based organizations, as well as other individuals of interest who would like to be here. But I'd like to also recognize, before you sit down, Rick Barton, who's the co-director of the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project, who really was one of the innovators in getting this dialogue going. And I'd be remiss if I didn't hold up the publication that came out of this called Mixed Blessing, because I think all of you in your remarks allude to the almost the squeamishness of the U.S. government to really take on this discussion because of our own domestic restrictions on church-state separation, about the important multiplier role that faith-based organizations play in the field, historically, as you say, from the beginning of written documentation, but more important, the fact that it is no longer a controversial issue as we look at this type of assistance as a major component of our foreign assistance, particularly in the humanitarian field. And I just wondered, and I wanted to ask you a quick question, perhaps, and that is, my sense is that the American public, who is a very generous community worldwide and continues to contribute, really, as a public, became much more aware of the importance of the private faith-based groups after the tsunami. It seemed to me that the press did a very useful job when that tragedy occurred in Asia to really highlight not only the faith-based organizations as faith-based, but their important work with the government, with the domestic governments who were afflicted. And I wondered if you had some ideas about how this really helped, in many ways, in the American eyes, at least in the government and official eyes, legitimize this role that has been going on for so long. Perhaps I'm wrong, but...
Yeah, I'll jump in. I think there have been two events in this century that I think have fundamentally reshaped the way Americans think about the world, and 9/11 was certainly one of them. And prior to 9/11, if you look at U.S. philanthropic giving, only about 2% of U.S. philanthropy, which is about $300 billion a year, goes internationally. 2% of the $300 billion. So I guess it's about $6 billion. But today, 7 years later, that's about 4%. It's almost doubled as a percentage of U.S. philanthropic giving. And I would actually credit 9/11 for being a seminal event that began to explode the awareness of America that we are not an island unto ourselves, that we are irrevocably connected to what happens in the rest of the world. And I think we've all seen an interest in international affairs increase pretty dramatically in this country. I think it has in the NGO sector, the international relief and development sector. most relief and development organizations have seen pretty dramatic growth over the last number of years, partially because of an increase in U.S. funding, government funding, but also U.S. private funding. I think the second event, the Asian tsunami, blew a window open in the media, and you might remember for about 30 days, that was all that was on CNN and most of the news stations, as America watched kind of vicariously what was happening in this tremendous humanitarian disaster, 230,000 deaths, five countries involved. And America got to see the suffering of the most vulnerable people, the poorest of the poor. And yes, during that time, the actions of faith-based organizations and all humanitarian organizations were much more prominent. We always say in the relief and development community that the media is never interested in you until there's an earthquake or a tsunami or some terrible humanitarian crisis that happens. And then the media window opens. Sometimes it's only for a week. Sometimes it's only for 2 days. And then it shuts again. And we're back to what Britney Spears happened this week in her life. And then I would mention a third event, Hurricane Katrina, which if the tsunami allowed us to see and picture in our minds the suffering of the poor, I think Hurricane Katrina brought it closer to home and made us feel in our guts and our hearts the suffering of the poor people just like us in the United States, and we realized that we were vulnerable as well to those things. And I think those three events have caused us to think differently about humanitarian response, what's happening around the rest of the world, the suffering of the poor. And I think the role of faith-based organizations, when FEMA was tripping over its boots, thousands of American churches and faith-based organizations were responding in the Gulf Coast and really doing a great work down there. And I think ultimately got a lot of credit for what they had done. And so I think those three things just in the last 7 years have shaped quite a bit the way Americans respond.
Thank you for clarifying. Janet?
Well, I would agree those events have been important in shaping the American conscious and awareness. But I would add that that's been happening against backdrop of globalization. And so even in the midst of those key events that you can kind of see easily, the world is changing, and it's changing pretty fast, and awareness about issues in the world and the sense of interconnectedness and the level of travel have all led to a much greater awareness among, you know, the average guy in the street here in the U.S. I heard just about a week ago that last year there were 1.5 Christians that went abroad on what are called short-term mission trips. 1.5 million Christians traveling to some other place on the planet to often stay in a church or in a local village and do a little work project and learn about another culture. That mass creates a base level of awareness that can fuel grassroots change, grassroots kind of cultural level shifting. And I think we need to recognize the possibility of tipping points along that process where, you know, there might be these key events that are coming into our mind, but there's this shifting base. And one thing I think foreign assistance has always lacked is that grassroots level of interest. And so foreign assistance has struggled. We've had a lack of coordination. It's really kind of been a mess. I know you don't need to hear that message, but if I was sitting in the seat of government looking back at the past few decades and the declining image and reputation of the U.S. and recognizing this very deep level grassroots type of shift going on and among my constituents, I think the time is ripe to get foreign assistance the level of coordination and attention and priority and frankly allocation that it deserves. And I think that I think more and more political leaders will see that as viable, even given the tough economy. You know, I know that the tough economy is probably going to shift a lot of people's minds back to domestic agenda, but that quote that you read earlier about America being great when we're good, and if we stop being good, we'll cease being great, I think it's really key for foreign policy.
I echo what Scott said. The you know, a statistic that's frequently quoted, which maybe even understates the situation, is about in the high 40% of the health care in Africa is delivered by faith-based organizations. Well, just one example of what Scott was getting at, the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria, and it's which hands out billions of dollars, has now committed over $9 billion to the fight against those three diseases. In its first couple of years, was giving about 4% of its grants to faith-based institutions. Now it's up to 6% today. So you might ask, is, you know, if you want to get the work done, are you putting your money in the right place? And now there's a number of reasons for that, and I don't want to be seen as a global fund basher because I'm not. I founded an NGO that does nothing but support the global fund, so I'm a big global fund booster. But the point is that there's a capacity out there that really can be very effective, and which I think the people who are involved in governmental institutions, and I spent almost 20 years of my life doing that, so I know something about how that works, really need to think more creatively about how that resource gets leveraged.
In the audience, perhaps I could take these three in front as a cluster and let you respond. So this gentleman here in the front row first.
Crowley for the Washington Times. I want to go back to the USAID part of this equation, and you mentioned, Richard, that there has been a decline from 14.2 to 13.5% in the allocation of foreign aid, but you compared it to 2004. This is Bush administration to Bush administration. I wonder if you have any observation on the, I suppose, rise of assistance to FBOs under President Bush, and do you have also an assessment of the way that the money has been allocated and the criteria that AID has when it does that?
I'm going to take two other questions because of time, and then okay. Let you get back. Lady, right side.
My name is Julie Taylor. I do research on the influence of Muslim clerics, and I think that a danger that I find in all of this is, whereas in the United States you have the ability for all people to be able to express their views, and so the empowerment of faith-based groups might seem like, you know, a really great thing. If you go to the Middle East and you're giving more money and attention to religious-based groups and religious leaders in a context in which religion is often used to try and silence other people, that then you can be participating in something in which, you know, you're empowering people who then are able to sort of subjugate others who are around them. Or at least maybe the government can be using this, like the empowerment of religion as a way to kind of, what we see is really the opposite there, which is a marginalization of secular groups. So do you see this as something that you should be concerned about in the Muslim world?
Thank you. And we'll take one last question and
then go. Hi, I'm Wendell Ballou, and I represent an association of Islamic faith-based organizations. And following in on this issue, and I'd like to take up a point in your excellent report, Mixed Blessings. I really commend that. One of the issues that was raised in the report is, how does USAID or other agencies of the U.S. government choose between faith-based groups? Certainly, I think in the Arab and Muslim world now, the perception is, and to some extent the reality, that it's basically the Christian groups that are supported, that are aid deliverers, at the same time that Islamic charities are being shut down and their assets are being frozen. One example is during the tsunami, former Presidents Clinton and Bush campaigned to raise a lot of money in a large part from faith-based organizations. They had a website with 300 organizations that were listed. Not one was Islamic. So there is this problem both of an operational problem. How does the government choose what organizations to partner with, especially faith-based organizations, and the problem of perception and public diplomacy?
Thank you. Why don't we turn over to begin?
You know, I'll take a stab at a couple of those. I may start with the last question. I think one of the challenges is that because America, according to my statistics, 83% of the citizens are Christian. And I think I just saw a number recently. There are 4 million Muslims in the United States. So 1 to 2% of the population Muslim. I think the proportion of Christian faith-based organizations versus Muslim is perhaps hundreds to one if you looked at the ratios of those two things. So just almost naturally money going to faith-based organizations will be predominantly Christian because of the weight of the population and the number of organizations that exist in the humanitarian space. You might find just the opposite in a predominantly Muslim country. You could argue, how come the Christian organizations aren't getting more funding? But I actually think the government should be blind to religion. And I don't think they should give us grants because we are Christian or because we are Muslim, with one footnote in there. I think they should look at the job that they want done, the thing that needs to be accomplished, and select the organization best equipped to do it. Now, if the job they want done is to mobilize, you know, imams and, you know, in a Muslim country around HIV and AIDS, they should probably give serious consideration to a Muslim faith-based organization that would be able to travel very easily in that space and maybe accomplish that because they have things on their resume that would lend themselves to that. But with those exceptions, I would prefer a government that was blind to these things and awarded on the basis of capacity and quality of work as a partner. So that, you know, and that somewhat addresses Julie's question. You talk about the kind of unwittingly walking into religious tensions or maybe inflaming religious tensions. And I haven't read the report, Mixed Blessing, but I mean, I think there's some truth to the fact that when you are working with religious groups in an international context, there is a two-edged sword. And we've even found it in the Christian community. If you go into a village in rural Africa and you work with a church in that village, that let's say it's Baptist, that church, but then you find out that the chief or the head man in the village is Episcopalian or Anglican. You can divide that community right in half just in the Christian community because you didn't work with the chief's church, and you step on political landmines, you know, in the community, and you haven't even left the Christian faith yet, you know, and you've got similar tensions between Orthodox, Roman Catholic, Protestant in different places. One of the policies we have at World Vision is we work with all expressions of the Christian faith in a particular community. So if we went into a African community, we would call all of the faith leaders together and not show favoritism. In fact, one of the mistakes sometimes American churches make in partnering is they'll select one church over another and then unwittingly create a political storm in the community because that one church now is puffed up over the other churches of the community, and it can lead to real serious issues. And we also try to convene across faith lines, Muslim, Buddhist, Hindu. And you have to be very careful navigating those boundaries and flashpoints because, as you know, sometimes the name of the political party that committed the genocide is the Christian Socialist Party or the you know, so the words are very careful. You have to be very cautious about the selection of words as well, because Christian here means one thing; it means something very different in the Balkans, and there's a whole history that goes with it that you have to understand. So, you do have to be very careful. And lastly, I didn't get your first name, but from the Washington Times, the only data my staff gave me were the 2004 to 2007 data on faith-based funding. To some extent, the first few years of the Bush administration were just trying to get the thing on its feet. So I don't know if the numbers would be that different if we had the numbers from 2000. One footnote to that data is that the numbers I quoted are the official, I think they're on the website, they're the official data of USAID. However, they don't take into account sub-granting. So it could be that, let's say, Save the Children of Care, secular organization, got a grant, and then because of the faith-based initiative made a sub-grant to a faith-based organization, it wouldn't have captured that data. And I think there has been a growth in the number of faith-based organizations that have received grants from USAID. So more faith-based organizations than ever before have received grants. I don't have the sub-grantee data, but the total balance of share of grants hasn't really shifted much in either direction. And I would say that World Vision sometimes is a lead grantee, and we subgrant to secular organizations like CARE, Save the Children. And sometimes CARE is a lead grantee or Save the Children, and they subgrant to World Vision. many of us work pretty seamlessly in the NGO community based on who's got the best professional skills or boots on the ground in a particular area to do the job.
And or Scott, do you want to comment on this?
I'll just say that I agree with what Rich's comments were. And in terms of how do you choose a partner, it should be on the basis of effectiveness and be blind to the religious affiliation there, with exception to possibly, you know, if you're intentionally working in a Muslim context with Muslim leaders and so on. I guess, you know, in terms of marginalization, to come back to your comment, we've certainly seen a history in which religion has been used to advance the evil purposes of humanity, and we've seen situations where religious faith has advanced the good purposes of humanity. So this idea of mixed blessings is really very true. And you definitely see cases where political leadership sort of usurps or capitalizes on that religious faith and channels that energy into an oppressive direction. I think that certainly speaking from a Christian perspective, that is not the faith that that was founded by Jesus Christ, and that's not the faith we're trying to encourage or promote. And by and large, that's not the faith we see among Christianity. I can't speak for the other world religions, but I can speak at least a little timidly for Christianity here. The thing that seems to happen in my mind, and it's just perception here, but we know most about our world through what the media tells us. Even those of us who've traveled a lot, who've seen a lot of the world, I mean, we're still very vulnerable to learning through this very narrow window of reflection on who are we. And, well, what is it that captures the media attention? It's what's going to sell us razor blades and automobiles. The only reason they exist is to create strategic discontent among a consumer base and get them out there to buy stuff. So when you find the stories of oppression, when you find the stories of scandal, those are the things that rise to the surface, and it drives us to have a perception that the world is like that. But I can tell you that just having been in many countries, I'm sure Rich can tell you the same, that's not characteristic. I mean, it just seems like about everywhere I go, I'm finding the good people. I'm finding the people like that pastor in El Salvador. I'm hearing the stories where it's not marginalization and oppression. It's uplifting stuff. But it doesn't show up in the media, and it doesn't really shape American consciousness. So,
and the same is true of Muslims and Buddhists. And
that may be. I just
most
know.
Of most of the people of faith that I encounter and work with internationally are people of goodwill as well. So we hear about the extremes in the news media because of the nature of, you know, if there's an attack in Mumbai, you hear about the extreme. And you don't hear about the very, you know, the peaceful monks in Myanmar that, you know, populate the schools and educate the children. And
so in a lot of ways, it's more of a media issue. So anybody here from the media, help us out. It's probably a PR type of thing. I think foreign assistance suffers the same way. People think the money went down a rat hole because we haven't done a good job telling the success stories. And there are success stories. So, one of the problems from a Christian perspective is also that Jesus had this teaching that whenever you give to the needy, and it was when you give to the needy, it wasn't if. When you give to the needy, don't announce it. Don't announce it with the trumpets so that everybody can see you and you can receive the praise of men. That's a Christian virtue. It's giving in secret. And that wasn't the only place it was taught. But it runs into its problems when you're trying to get a PR issue in a society where you know you don't own public perception and you're not even going to toot your own horn. So if Ed wants to toot our horn for us, we could.
Well, it sounds
I'm happy to do that.
With the Interfaith Action Center.
I know, thank you.
Well, I think we're really talking, though. I think the one question I come back to is we're talking about effective boots on the ground. That's what it really is all about. I mean, I'm up here and I'm involved in these issues. And I will say, you know, unapologetically, not because of my strong religious convictions. I'm here because of my strong conviction about efficacy. And I think it is all our duties, whether we're strongly religious or not, to help our fellow man. And I think effective boots on the ground is a very, very compelling issue. And I think that's the thing that we ought to be thinking about. And I think that's what World Vision and Catholic Relief and Compassion and all the other people who are doing this work really represent.
I think we have time for one more question, or there are two. Why don't we take them together? And this gentleman in the front.
I could probably do it without the mic.
Okay.
My name is Frank Dahl. I work at GWU. I'm also an international governments and so on. My experience in about 90 countries now and many years, 37 years of development experience, is that that isn't necessarily the case in every case. But aside from that, what I'd like to do is challenge you all into getting out of fashionable trends in aid, and the fashionable trend in aid at the moment is to give a lot of attention to HIV/AIDS at the moment, and we're talking now about health, of course. I do education as well. What about malaria and tuberculosis? Both of those, actually, if you look at the numbers at the moment, and I work with WHO, are probably as serious, if not more serious, than HIV/AIDS. What are we doing to address those issues? They're often linked. And why is it that we're just jumping on the HIV/AIDS bandwagon? Is it because it's mandated by government, and certainly this government, because a lot of money was put into that, and it was a deliberate strategy of the outgoing administration? Or is it that that you think it is more important than the than the other two? Because I think the other two are equally important, from my experience,
well,
anyway.
Should we take the last question? Take the other question, too.
We'll answer that. This gentleman in the ear had a question. Last row.
Thank you for your comments. Stephen Bowman, World Relief. One question I get often is, what happens when the assistance stops, the foreign assistance, if you will, in our case, whether that's private or coming from the U.S. government through World Relief? We put a lot of effort and strategy into designing programs that carry on without us, using that social and spiritual capital that comes from faith communities, primarily local churches, but also communities beyond that. And so I'm just wondering about your comments on that. We have anecdotal evidence that there's some spiritual and social capital that carry programs on way beyond our assistance in an effective manner. We're measuring some of it, again, anecdotally, not widespread research. So I do think that contributes towards the effectiveness. I agree with Rich and Scott, all of you, about the government being blind, but then really giving aid based on performance. And one of those key factors in performance should be, well, sustainability is probably the word, whether that's economic, if it's a agriculture program or microfinance, but also behavioral sustainability, if it's changing norms in a whole population, values and so forth. So I'm just interested in your comments on that, if you're seeing that too at Compassion World Vision, also in some of the organizations you're working with too, Ed.
Let me start with this gentleman's question here. With regard to the AIDS bandwagon, I would beg to differ that when we got involved, there was no bandwagon for AIDS. Not only was the American public not interested, but the U.S. government was doing virtually nothing on USAID, on HIV and AIDS. And I think it was largely because of some of the advocacy done in this country by not just World Vision, but other organizations, faith-based and secular, as well as other faith leaders, you know, from Rick Warren to Franklin Graham to many who spoke out about AIDS, we were able to put AIDS on the map for the American public, and especially the American church-going public, where, as I alluded to in my comments, you know, 1990 wanted nothing to do with HIV and AIDS. It was God's judgment, and it was a homosexual disease, and it was not something they were interested in, not the most pleasant side of the evangelical community, I might say. So through a lot of effort and against the recommendations of my own marketing people, back in 2000, 2001, we tackled HIV publicly in the United States with our donors and our constituents, and paid a bit of a price initially because there was such reluctance to hear about this issue. You know, one of my team said, if you take us into this issue, it's going to ruin our reputation. We're a G-rated family ministry going into an R-rated issue. And so I like to say we built the bandwagon, you know, and maybe others have jumped on it, but we built the bandwagon. And you are absolutely right about malaria and tuberculosis. And I think if I just look at World Vision, it might have been my own zeal about HIV that caused me to be a little less interested in malaria and tuberculosis. We are now mounting a fairly major malaria initiative within World Vision. And again, we think we have a unique asset that our boots on the ground. Malaria is something that has to be treated, obviously, one household at a time, one community at a time, bed nets and distribution. We have about 34,000 staff in 100 countries, so we have the boots on the ground that if we mobilize them in the right way, we can deliver tremendous not only educational messages about malaria prevention, but also household and individual interventions with bed nets and maybe even spraying. So we're doing that. We do a fair amount of work with tuberculosis, although we're not a health provider per se. So I've been to places where we have tuberculosis clinics, but we are not primarily a health provider. We try to connect communities with the health system in that country when they're often not connected very well. So we want to get another bandwagon going on malaria and tuberculosis as well, and we try to be blind to those, the popularity of various causes, and really try. We just had a discussion this morning about what are the things that are killing children, what are the things that are driving mortality rates high, and those are the things that we need to be tackling: clean water, malaria interventions, et cetera.
I'd like to comment on the malaria issue as well. I'm on the board of Malaria No More, which has been the former
head of which is now works directly for the Secretary General of the UN, and this new organization I referred to, CIFA, the Center for Interfaith Action on Global Poverty. We're having a meeting this Friday at Georgetown with all these people from all these faith organizations on one subject, malaria. And the reason we're having it is because we have the kind of interventions that are necessary at the community level to eliminate malaria in a particular area, and you know the whole strategy that people are using now to shrink the malaria map, require significant community engagement. One of the more successful interfaith actions against malaria is taking place in Mozambique, where there's 11 different faith groups combining together to combat malaria. Zanzibar, which has eliminated malaria for the third time, by the way, did it very much with the involvement of the Muslim community in Zanzibar. Otherwise, it never would have gotten done. And they sustain that with very, very active engagement with the faith community. But you're absolutely right. Malaria is a huge problem. 500 million people a year are touched by it. And about 85% of the deaths are children in Africa under the age of 5. So it's a big deal. But I think the faith community is definitely on that issue, and I think we're going to see progress in the next 5 years.
I'll jump in, too, as a health guy, and then we can shift to answering this question from the back. But, Compassion's been fighting AIDS in Africa for 25 years. And really, it was about that same time, early 2000, when we were making it a public agenda issue within the U.S. We provide comprehensive child development programs. We have over 1 million children in our programs worldwide. We do analysis of what are the leading threats to their well-being, the leading causes of disease. We did see AIDS climbing, but it's never hit the level that malaria has. So we have had malaria response, comprehensive medical programs. So our HIV response is an integrated part of our health program. We've distributed about 300,000 insecticide-treated nets as well as provided treatment for malaria, and we've actually seen the rate of malaria in the sample projects in one of our studies from around 2003, where it accounted for 75% of the clinical visits for children in our programs, down to last year where it was below 20%. So these prevention strategies absolutely work. Malaria is an important priority. I think we can celebrate, though, that for whatever reasons, the environment in the United States led to an awareness about HIV and AIDS, and it got public attention. It got on the news. It got into the kind of public consciousness. Then we started looking at the 1 million people that were here within our national boundaries suffering and took our eyes up for a second and realized at that time we thought there were 39 million people out there in the rest of the world, and 2/3 of them were in Africa. And then we started looking at Africa, and then we started realizing, well, there's a lot of other issues in Africa. We've got things like malaria and tuberculosis. So in other words, the awareness about AIDS, that bandwagon, which I think maybe Compassion stuck a spoke on Rich's bandwagon, we've leveraged that. And now these issues like malaria are receiving public attention. And that's a good thing.
You know, I know you want to answer a question on sustainability, but we've also gone a little bit over our time. I'd like to let you have a chance to make a quick wrap-up, but I know that a lot of people had hands up that we weren't able to get to. So when we close this session, I hope that you gentlemen might be able to stay for a few minutes and answer some personal questions of individuals. But
I
I'd like to
personal questions, but we can answer
well
professional questions.
I assume
you didn't
that
read the fine print on this deal.
There's no proselytization in the room, in other words, afterwards. But do you want to just give
a quick just quickly, and then maybe Scott would answer this too. Obviously, sustainability is the name of the game for anybody that's in development work, because you don't want to just go in, do something good, and leave, and it all falls apart. I think whether you're secular or faith-based, that's the goal. Again, one of the advantages that faith-based organizations may have in sustainability is to the extent that you can implant those educational principles and knowledge in existing institutions like churches or mosques or temples, civil society institutions that are going to be there after you leave, to the extent you can do that, you have maybe some advantage. But we don't do it only in faith institutions. You know, we try to get the the local tribal leadership, if it's an African community, and we form these community coalitions as well, recognizing that not everybody is part of a faith-based institution or a church locally. So if you're going to have it sustainable, you have to get it into those things as well. One other advantage, and I actually Compassion and World Vision have this advantage to some extent, is many of my NGO colleagues live and die on government grants. Most of their funding is government grants. And you might get a three-year grant, but then it's gone. And you have to lay off the staff or redeploy them. And so you're in and you're out, 3 years, 5 years. It might only be a grant for one intervention. It might just be for child survival or just for microfinance. One of the advantages we have with our private funding is it's sustainable over decades, not 3 years. So we might be in a community for 10, 15, 20 years on child sponsorship funding that allows us to stay there. We might bring in a government grant in year three and finish it in year six, and we can add that on top. So it gives us more time to really deal with the root causes of poverty so that when we leave, there is a sustainable flywheel that's turning in that community, as opposed to the relative schizophrenia of government grants. I mean, this is not to talk about the ineffectiveness of foreign assistance, which we see some of the flaws, but it can be very schizophrenic sometimes in countries in terms of what's the priority today.
I thank you for that. And we could probably spend the rest of the afternoon in a very rich conversation, but I know some of our speakers have other commitments and have to leave. Why don't we give our speakers a round of applause for with the hope that you'll come back and continue in the next